Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, delivering clarity in a world of constant noise. In the next 30 minutes, beyond the headlines, with sharp insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping the future. Whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with the stories that matter. And coming up on the program, will the publishing of a national register of sex offenders help prevent sexual violence? Why South Africa needs tangible action and implementation instead of empty promises when it comes to the professionalization of the public sector? A look ahead to Budget 2025. Can government balance fiscal discipline and investor confidence? And can private capital unlock growth, jobs and innovation in South Africa? It's Thursday, the 13th of February. The fight against sexual violence in South Africa has taken a significant step forward, with government's announcement of the National Register for Sex Offenders set to be made public by the end of this month. The register is designed to protect vulnerable individuals from potential harm by barring sex offenders from working in sensitive environments. The South African Human Rights Commission has welcomed this move, emphasizing its role in strengthening protection, increasing accountability, and preventing repeat offenses. I want to discuss the broader implications of this initiative, and I'm joined now by Norma Hlubi Quinana, who is a commissioner at the Human Rights Commission. Commissioner, welcome. Thank you very much indeed. So from your perspective, how will making this register publicly available enhance the protection of vulnerable individuals?
Thank you so much, Jeremy, for this opportunity. From where we're sitting, this is something that was supposed to have been done a while back already. And how we think that it is going to ensure that there's protection of the vulnerable individuals. It is so because there's going to be now a register from which any employer can refer from as to who appears on the list, which will then entail that the correct people will then be appointed to positions that are not tainted or that are not implicated insofar as a violation of rights of vulnerable members of our community, whether it's children, older persons, or persons with disabilities.
Commissioner, of course, it looks good in theory, but there have got to be measures in place to ensure that this register is both effectively implemented and maintained.
No, that is so. That is why, you know, from where we're sitting is we will definitely also then monitor how same is being implemented, because it would also not serve any purpose for it to just be there and not being used optimally. So it would be important to then impress upon all those that are likely to employ anyone to ensure that same is being used.
There's also an ethical issue attached to this. The register has got to make sure that it balances public safety on the one hand, also though with the rights of offenders who have served their sentences. Again, it comes down to proper implementation.
Now that is correct, but unfortunately it is so that one can never overlook the history that unfortunately you have lived in your lifetime. Of course, unless there has been expungement, in those instances, obviously, it's almost unavoidable that some people might find themselves no longer in the list. But for as long as it affects children, persons with disability, and older persons, we might have to make sure that that information remains for the longest time, because you know, whilst you could be rehabilitated, reformed, and even be deterred from ever committing such an offense, your history will always prevail.
It is controversial by its very nature. I'm wondering if the Commission is foreseeing any legal or constitutional challenges to the publication of this register.
It is so. It is likely going to be challenged a lot, as you have rightly pointed out, because it could be raised each time when somebody tries to move on in their lifetime. But of course, you know, what is imperative is the protection of the vulnerable members of the community, and that should, supersede any other right.
Commissioner, you talk about the time delay in implementing this initiative, and I accept that. The tragedy, of course, is that it's taken such a long time, and so many people's lives could have turned out differently had it been implemented earlier. Having said that, it is in place now. Do you think this compares favorably to other initiatives in other countries?
Well, it does. At least we are moving a step forward. At least something is now being done. And that should, in a way, be favorable on our side. But it is so that as Human Rights Commission, we continue to be concerned, even when we look at different bills that are still sitting on the desk of the president and not being signed. It becomes a concern because it allows situations that would not have been allowed to continue.
One of the other concerns, Commissioner, is that public access to the register could lead to stigma or even vigilante justice. That's a real concern, isn't it?
That is the truth. That is the truth, because at all times, for as long as your name appears on that list, it is so that one would always be tainted in a way. But it is what it is. It's unavoidable. And that is why we're looking at it as a form of deterrence, you know, general deterrence, if one has to put it that way, that it could assist other would-be offenders to keep themselves off, you know, any criminal acts in order for them not to ever find their names in the list.
Just finally, I'm assuming that you have plans in place to monitor and assess the long-term effectiveness of this register. What is your planning going forward?
For now, we would want to see the register now ultimately being publicized. And Jeremy, as you are aware, from our side in terms of our mandate, it is then also to continue with monitoring in order to ensure that there's no violation of human rights or the culture thereof. So at this point in time, we have not yet come up with a plan. But same will definitely develop as at the time we now have the register. And we'll do that which we are supposed to do only in terms of our mandate, Jeremy. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Noma Hlubi Quinana, Commissioner at the South African Human Rights Commission.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The latest State of the Nation address promising a capable, competent and ethical state. But for many, these commitments might feel like a deja vu. We've kind of heard this before, haven't we? The Institute of Directors in South Africa says it welcomes the intention behind President Ramaphosa's vision, but also questions whether this time there's going to be anything different. Despite promises to strengthen the role of the Public Service Commission in senior appointments, ministers will still have the final say in public sector board selections. That is raising concerns about continued political interference. So my question is, what needs to change to ensure that state-owned enterprises and public institutions are led by ethical, skilled and independent professionals? And underline that word independent. Joining me now to discuss this, the Chief Executive Officer of the Institute of Directors, Pami Natasan. Pami, a very warm welcome to you. So why does the Institute believe the latest SONA promises on professionalizing the public service might remain unfulfilled? What are your concerns here?
Yes, so I think the thing is that we hear the same thing far too often. And I'm sure you and I have spoken before at the times of previous SONAs with exactly the same issues, where government promises to do certain things. And in our instance, It's to professionalize the way that board members of SOEs, etc., are appointed. Great intention, but we don't really see follow through, which I guess is the big issue. Are we going to hear the same thing again next year with no real changes happening?
What's the real concern here? How do flawed board appointments contribute to governance failures within SOEs? And we know there have been so many.
Yeah, so it's very important that we appoint the right board members. They have a really important role and responsibility in overseeing these SOEs and ensuring that these SOEs are successful and ultimately deliver on their mandates and drive South Africa forward. And in doing so, there are director competencies that need to be considered. So are the people that are being appointed competent to serve? Do they have a background in business? Do they understand how to read a set of financial statements? Do they have the moral compass? Do they understand their director's duties to act in the best interest of the entity, not in the best interest of themselves or their political party or in any other affiliation? Now, I'm not saying that we don't have great board members in SOEs, and I'm sure there have been many great appointments made of recent times. But I think the issue is that the actual appointment process itself is not clear or transparent to us, and probably is inconsistently applied in the various ministries. You know, the IOD worked many years ago on a guide to the appointment of SOEs with the Department of Public Services and Administration, which we felt would have made a really positive difference in standardizing the way in which board members are nominated and finally elected onto these SOE boards. But unfortunately, that also wasn't implemented or wasn't approved.
So the call now is for what the IOD calls competency-based board appointments. How does that process actually work?
So the IOD, we have what we call a director competency framework, which lists both the technical and social or personal competencies that we feel a good director should have. And what we really need to see is the criteria for shortlisting of these board members and for interviewing these potential candidates and for finally selecting these candidates is the proper criteria being used to assess whether the individuals have the competencies necessary to serve as directors.
Is it difficult to find that competency, do you think? Or do those skills exist? We're just not trying hard enough to find them.
I think the skills exist. I mean, we have a number of members of ours who are designated either certified directors or chartered directors, which means they've been through a rigorous process of learning and assessment to test whether they display those competencies. So I think they do exist. I think the issue is opening up the nominations process to consider individuals that are perhaps not aligned to certain political parties or known to certain key influential people.
But Pami, it's also difficult to take the political dynamic or the political framework entirely out of the system, given the unique nature of SOEs. Is there a way in which to find some kind of compromise here?
I think you're right. I think it's difficult to completely take away the political influence of it. The bottom line for me is, do the candidates meet the director competencies necessary, and are they going to act in the best interest of the entity, not necessarily the best interest of who appointed them? I think that that's sort of the balance for me is, you know, even if people are being appointed or are known to the minister, etc., they must still at least as a minimum meet the competencies and act in the best interest of the SOE.
So going around this whole debate again, what does the Institute plan to do about this? You've raised the issue. Are you applying more pressure to government, or are you not expecting anything to change as a result of the very earnest statements that were made in the State of the Nation address, but as you have pointed out, unlikely to result in any meaningful follow-through?
I think we'll continue to raise our voice on this matter. It's really critical for us, especially in our drive to professionalize directorship in general, not just in the public sector. So we'll continue to take whatever opportunity we can to raise awareness about the importance of this matter and hopefully in the future drive change.
And just quickly, are there international models of SOE governance that South Africa might be looking to learn from?
I think globally this is a challenge, so I'm not sure that the answer is out there.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor Pami Natasan, Chief Executive Officer of the Institute of Directors, South Africa. Pami, thank you so much.
MoneyWeb at midday. Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
With Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana set to deliver Budget 2025 on the 19th of February, South Africa is facing some tough economic realities. What are they? Well, slow growth, rising debt and an urgent need to maintain investor confidence. The government has got to strike a delicate balance between spending and fiscal discipline, but it's also got to ensure structural reform in energy, transport and manufacturing. But there's also limited room for tax hikes and there are growing debt concerns. So where on earth are we left as far as all of this is concerned? Let's try and cut through the trees here. Martin Ackermann is with us, Chief Economist at Citadel. Martin, a very warm welcome to you. Let me start with the biggest picture then, or the big picture. What are the chief economic challenges, difficulties that the minister is facing heading into budget 2025? Not a lot of room to maneuver.
No, you're 100% right there. It's, your intro made it quite clear that we're between a rock and a hard place. The sad thing is, you know, we can almost play this for the last 5 years, for the last five budgets, medium-term budgets included. You know, we always say this is going to be a very tough one. The minister needs to have a fine balancing act. And the reason for that is quite simple. You know, it is not because we are spending more than linked to inflation. It is just because the economy for the last 5 years are still stagnating. And we're not seeing economic growth picking up. And as a result of that, you know, tax revenue is under huge pressure. And that means that we need to go and borrow more. So this is almost a repeat of the movie, like I said, over the last couple of years. So the most important thing, again, during this budget is to say, well, what can we do and what are they doing to actually try and get us out of this growth trap? Because high growth will fix many of the issues that we are facing.
And getting out of that trap, Martin, is balancing growth with fiscal discipline, as I mentioned a little earlier. But that's very difficult to achieve. So I wonder how realistic that is, given government's current high debt levels.
Yeah, so the problem is, you know, while we patiently wait for higher, more sustainable growth, and we can get back to that, you know, the most important thing then is to make sure that you keep expenses under control. So now you're talking about the big things in the budget, like the wage bill. So, you know, don't increase the number of people in the public sector. Make sure that you don't pay excessive inflation increases. I saw today it seems like they're going to settle on about 5.5, which is still higher than inflation, but, you know, at least it's not closer to 10%. So try and keep those things under control, because also remember a lot of that spending that, for example, the interest payment, you know, we can't get away from that. We need to balance the budget by borrowing more. As a result of that, 22% of the budget is going to service interest. The wage bill that we just spoke about, not much that we can do about that unless you start firing a big part of the public sector, which is not popular. And that leaves you with, well, not a lot to spend on the real issues, which is things like structural reform, logistical networks, education, healthcare. So it is to find the balancing act between those things that's eating up whatever revenue gets, focusing on where we need to spend to really get the economy going, and then dealing with a very mediocre revenue side, which is a function of low economic growth. And we've been managing that for the last couple of years by borrowing more, and the foreigners are willing to help us there. Well, not the foreigners only, you know, the local investment community as well, because we got very attractive yields, but that is not sustainable. So I guess, yeah, the challenge for the minister again is to say, well, how in this very challenging environment can we still just balance the budget, keep that primary surplus, which is very important, try and prevent debt dynamics running away. But then importantly, again, getting back to the table and say, what do we need to do to actually get the growth going? Because that will sort out most of our problems.
And all the while this is happening, the clock is ticking louder. How much longer can we keep borrowing before patience runs out?
Now, so every budget, they tell us that the debt to GDP number is going to top out, peak out over the next budget framework, the next 3 years. But slowly that number is getting higher year after year after year. So, you know, Minister Mboweni at the time warned about a debt spiral. We're fortunate that we avoided that for the time being. But, you know, we're definitely not out of the woods yet. So, yes, the clock is ticking. And, you know, I would say that, you know, we need to get more sustainable growth probably in the next 3 years. Otherwise, you know, if we don't get that, we need to start trimming back on other important things in the budget. And that's a real risk. You know, the moment you can't keep on paying social grants or keep social grants linked to inflation, now you're creating a social challenge that can be quite negative for the economy. That's on the local side. Now, we know that to get growth going, you know, we need to fix the structural issues, and we are making some progress on the electricity front. Next in line is all the logistical issues, the ports, the rails, and there's some legislation on the table. But we know that, you know, those things don't happen overnight. So you first remove the red tape, provide tax incentives like they did with the solar, and then probably 2 years later you start to see the results. So even if we assume that this year we will be full out implementing some of these policies, the results in the economy is probably only going to show up in the next 3 years. And then just as an aside, unfortunately, you know, suddenly we're dealing with a global economy that is much more volatile. We have very an open economy, so suddenly we're facing those headwinds. And just all the kind of tension that's developing as we speak between us and some of our biggest trading partners like the US. That is another hurdle that's going to prove, well, can, you know, be a hurdle in terms of getting us to where we want to be if we don't play that right. So that, you know, is not a budget issue, but that is definitely something that we need to keep in mind as part of getting to more sustainable numbers.
And Martin, just a final one. We can't have this conversation without referencing tax. We know that the tax burden in this country is already high. Are you expecting any major tax hikes, or is government inevitably going to have to look elsewhere for revenue?
Yeah, so I think, you know, in terms of most of our taxes, we like you said, pretty much on the upper range. They talk about the Laffer curve, which implies that even though they increase the tax rates, the marginal increase in revenue might be not in line with that, because, you know, people think differently how they pay tax. They might even think about leaving the country and have a different tax jurisdiction. And I think Treasury is well aware of that. Also, you know, we've been in this kind of squeeze for the last number of years, like we said. So they already had the opportunity to really increase tax, but they always tried to find other solutions, especially on maintaining expenses and trying to manage the debt demand. But never say never. So I know that Treasury is looking into alternative ways to broaden the tax base, other areas where they could potentially increase tax revenue. So I don't think it's off the table. And probably one of the you know, maybe not the most popular one, but the one where you know exactly what you're going to get from today, from tomorrow, is the VAT rate. Because the VAT rate most people pay, you'll get it from tomorrow. It's very different from, let's say, capital gains tax, where the investor can decide whether they're going to make those changes and pay the tax. But especially in a year like last year, you know, hiking VAT is not very popular in an election year. So those things, yeah, we can't say it's not going to happen, but that's definitely a possibility that could probably come into the budget, especially if they start thinking about making the VAT a variable VAT rate, so very low on typical stuff. You know, there's already things excluded, the zero VAT on like bread and those things, that component they can increase. But you can also go and make a big case to say, well, you've got a variable VAT system where you pay very low VAT on consumer staples, but on consumer discretionary, you know, you can double the VAT rate. So right. You want to go and buy a fancy car, you're going to pay more. So those things, I think, is something that one can't just say it's not going to happen. There's definitely a possibility for that, given where we are at this point in time.
Well, I guess the hard truth is going to be revealed in a week's time. Martin Ackermann, thank you very much indeed, Chief Economist at Citadel.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
President Ramaphosa's latest State of the Nation address, placing strong emphasis on private capital as a key driver of economic growth, job creation and infrastructure development. All well and good, with structural reforms and public-private partnerships gaining momentum, the role of venture capital and private investment in unlocking economic potential, I would suggest, has never been more critical. But is the policy environment evolving fast enough to support this? What needs to change in order to encourage investment, particularly in high-growth sectors and, I imagine, small business? So let's explore some of those issues. I'm joined by Tsepiso Kubile, who is Chief Executive Officer of the Southern African Venture Capital Association. Tsepiso, a very warm welcome to you. So the key takeaways from your perspective from SONA for the private capital market, how encouraged were you?
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you for having me on the show. I think your introduction was spot on. The president definitely touched on a number of topics that, in my mind, align very well with the work that we do and the advocacy that we have been busy about with at SAFCA with regard to private equity, private debt, and venture capital. In specifically, he touched on a number of areas that fall within the banner of interventions that would drive sustainable growth and job creation. He spoke about infrastructure, which, as we all know, is an area where we have been underinvesting over a number of years as a country. And that has become apparent in the growth of our country. And it's an area where we have been highlighting over the last year or so that given the large quantums of capital that are needed, it cannot be funded through the fiscus alone. It's definitely an area that requires private sector investment. And private equity and private debt have proven over the years that they are well positioned to plug that gap and well positioned to act as that conduit for local institutional capital into infrastructure. We saw, for example, that in 2023, about 40% of investments that were being made by our members were actually into the infrastructure and energy sectors. The president also touched on employment creation, and we know that we live in a country where, according to the stats, our SMMEs contribute about 36% to GDP, yet employ over 60% of our workforce. And we've always argued that that's where employment creation is going to come from. So when you're talking about an asset class here that actually is channeling capital into the growth of SMMEs, giving them expansion capital, that, of course, makes a compelling reason for why we should take this asset class seriously from a regulatory point of view and create an enabling environment for capital to flow into it and for those funds to then channel that capital into businesses.
Fair enough. So a far more benign and more positive environment, but the challenge, I guess, is for South Africa to find ways of better unlocking domestic institutional capital to complement international investment. And I think the argument is that there's been something of an understandable reluctance to do that in the past.
I wouldn't place it on just reluctance alone, Jeremy, to be honest. If I reflect on the conversations that we have been having as an advocacy body with various stakeholders that are involved in private markets, I think it touches on a number of areas. So firstly, there's the history. We definitely can't deny the fact that over a number of years, we had international aid agencies playing a critical role in the private equity space. It was a very new asset class for a lot of our investors. They didn't understand it very well. And so we needed the DFIs who have had exposure to it in the more developed markets to then take on that catalytic role. Now, added to that, with that asset class still being relatively nascent in our environment, there's a lot of education that has had to go into helping our institutional investors understand it better and be comfortable with its risk profile and what it means for them, given that they do have responsibilities ultimately to their beneficiaries. Been a lot of education that needed to happen in that space as well, added to that research that would enable better decision-making by them.
Sapisa, let me ask you what I think might be a key question. It's early stage companies, people who have started a business and it's in a nascent stage. How do they gain faster access to capital and therefore opportunity? And what obstacles still stand in their space? Because if you unlock that pipeline, it's going to improve aspects like infrastructure investment, surely.
Certainly, one of the key areas, and this was also alluded to in the SONA, that where we have seen a gap, if one talks about early stage companies specifically and how one moves them along that life cycle to a point where they are able to then capture or be at a stage where they are VC ready. There isn't sufficient capital in those relatively early parts of their life cycle. South Africa doesn't have as thriving an angel community as other areas do. So it was interesting to see that an innovation fund, for example, is being mooted, but we want more detail, you know, because what you want to see is the extent to which that fund becomes complementary to the VC funds that are already there, understand the complexities, etc. So what that capital is then meant to do is to then be catalytic in nature and move those deals to a point where they become VC ready. So that's the first intervention. The second one, I think, is that we actually do need to have a more balanced understanding of risk, I think, as a country. We find, for example, that South African institutional investors are still quite risk averse, and the same has been said of our banks and others. But they're quite risk averse when it comes to dipping their toes into VC, for example. You know, whereas we're seeing momentum on private equity, private debt, certainly in the early stages, they're still not as keen to get involved there. But I think that is a function of lack of information and understanding around the asset class, which to some extent possibly may have been driven by the fact that the institutional investors maybe are seeing what is reported in more developed markets around asset stripping and what these fund managers do, etc., which is completely not what happens in our environment. So there may be that information gap as well.
A very valuable perspective on private investment in South Africa, particularly as that infrastructure build project becomes more and more critical. Sapisa Kubile, thank you very much indeed, Chief Executive Officer of the Southern African Venture Capital Association. And that's our program for today. Back tomorrow with another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.